morning we're talking about The Geography of Hope, a book by Chris Turner and published by Random House Canada, available at good bookstores everywhere. The Geography of Hope opens with Chris Turner overlooking Calgary and the skyscraper headquarters of the big oil companies like Chevron, Shell, and Halliburton. His gaze then shifts over to the sour gas flares that spew CO2 from the natural gas wells on Scotsman's Hill. And it all makes him wonder what the environmental future holds for his newborn daughter. And to answer that question, he undertook a world tour to prove that all is not lost, that we can find a fix. And he crisscrossed the world researching environmental good news stories, typically small but highly effective initiatives from wind farms in Denmark to micro hydroelectric projects in Thailand. Chris Turner, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, first, maybe you could just explain the subtitle of the book, A Tour of the World We Need. Why was your tour one that we all need, if not to do ourselves, but to at least read about?
Well, I think the necessity of it is obviously, you know, the need for a much broader and more thoroughgoing response to the threat of catastrophic climate change, basically. We are in the early days now of a pretty major shift in the way the world's climate functions. And essentially the only way to contain the extent of that change is to begin rethinking dramatically how we live. That usually freaks people out a little bit, and they think, "Oh, I don't think I want to, you know, give up the life I have." And so I think that the tour aspect of my book was to sort of say, "Well, we know we have the tools to address this problem. We're not using them very widely, but they are being used in pockets here and there. So, what do they look like? What are those tools? What sort of society is being built with them?" And this was not necessarily to say that every single community on Earth needs to do exactly this laundry list of 6 or 8 or 10 things. More to say, here's actually a world worth building. Here's a lifestyle worth aspiring to, as opposed to a terrifying, disastrous future that I think it often dominates the conversation about where we're headed on this issue.
How many projects did you start off with on your long list, if you will, and how did you possibly whittle them down to the relatively few you could handle in the book?
Yeah, I don't know if I could enumerate it. It was a little bit like following trails of breadcrumbs, and sometimes you got somewhere good and sometimes you didn't. One thing would lead to another. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is I went to rural Thailand thinking I was going to look at this solar project that basically the Thai government had organized, where they put solar panels on about 250,000 houses that had never had electricity. I did see some of the solar panels, but really the story turned out to be this amazing little micro hydro project that was going on in the same village. And so there was a lot of sort of happenstance and luck, and you know, you'd get to one place and someone would point you in the direction of the next, I couldn't tell you how many how many things remained on the drawing board. It was a lot of trial and error involved before you found the real meat of the book.
And one of the enjoyable parts that I found about this book is it's not a dry scientific or environmental tome. It's partially travelogue, mm-hmm. partially you riffing on some of your background and growing up, a bit of a blog sense to it too. But coming back to the travel aspect of it, you describe traveling with your wife and often your infant daughter at times. Mm-hmm. What were some of the challenges of traveling with an infant like that and some of these very rural areas that you were visiting often?
Well, we didn't. My wife and daughter weren't with me for everything. So, for example, the Thai village I mentioned, my wife and daughter stayed in Bangkok while I was there. They were with me though in India. They were with me in New Mexico and Colorado when I was down there. So, I mean, in terms of challenges, I mean, it's like travel generally with a kid. You have to move a little bit slower and take a little bit more care. But for all that, I think it's hugely rewarding to travel with your family and to as I sort of describe it in the book, to really sort of have some of, you know, hopefully some of my daughter's first memories be of some of this fantastic sort of new world that I was exploring.
You describe your background growing up in Northern Ontario and your first car being a Mustang,
mm-hmm.
but also you describe eventually turning into a, maybe not a Greenpeace activist, but at least a fundraiser in Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
But growing up in Northern Ontario, that's a car culture. How did it feel for a future Greenpeace member to be growing up in such a entrenched car culture and knowing that in the future you're going to be writing a book like this?
Well, I think the thing about, you know, when you're a teenager, particularly in you know, a fairly small, not terribly cosmopolitan place, you kind of lack the tools to even imagine something dramatically different from where you are in a lot of cases. This was particularly true, you know, in the days before the internet and all the other sort of communications technologies made it much easier to find out what was going on in the big old world out there. So I think, I mean, you know, the car culture of North Bay, Ontario was just, you know, that's just how it was. The idea that there'd be something different from that, that there might be, you know, a different kind way of living is just, I mean, that option isn't sort of on the table in a place like that. For all that, though, I think, you know, like a lot of people of, you know, my age and younger even, I was never far from my mind that really as soon as I sort of came to some sort of, you know, political consciousness, whenever that is in your early teens, that there was this environmental problem out there and that it was, you know, very bad and getting much worse. And that just seemed to be this constant narrative running through my childhood was how much worse things were getting, you know, first starting with, you know, species extinction, acid rain and things like that. And then suddenly climate change comes onto the map and you know, and it's the sort of mother of all those problems.
We, the public, have been getting beaten up more and more recently with global warming, climate change, acid rain years ago. When I watch films like Inconvenient Truth and The End of Suburbia, I just feel that I'm getting eco-fatigue sometimes. I want to go home and crawl up in a ball and just close the shutters and go away. How does... Was that a motivation for your book and to get us out of that eco-fatigue syndrome?
Yeah, I would say that probably the primary motive for the book was that right there, to really address the fact that most of the conversation around climate change has been about how bad it might be, arguing about who's at fault. And it's not that those conversations don't have validity. It just seemed like no one was talking much about, you know, what sort of changes we were talking about making and whether or not they were good ideas to pursue. And you know, there'd been a couple of studies. There's one that I cite in the book in 2004 in the journal Science that had come out of Princeton saying, you know, we have the know-how, we have the tools to solve this problem. And I thought, well, why isn't that story getting more widely told? Why aren't we talking about what the society or what the world we're going to build looks like then? I obviously with the hope and intent to describe something that sounded pretty good, and really I had my expectations far exceeded everywhere I went. I think I thought I would be looking at something that felt a little less ready to roll, so to speak, and really I was just, you know, constantly amazed and delighted to find just how close at hand these tools are.
Ready to roll, you just use that phrase, but when I watch a film, I read with fascination your stories of the wind farms on Samoso and the small-scale hydroelectric projects in Thailand, and then I go to see a film like Ed Burtynsky's Manufactured Landscapes, and I look at these scenes of China, just an oceans and mountains of industrial wastelands out there, and I think, how do I reconcile 40 windmills on Samoso with a problem that seems to be the scale of China and India?
Yeah, and obviously it's maybe not easy at first to sort of look at it that way. On the other hand, I don't think I don't think we are going to get past this problem by becoming, you know, sort of meticulous chroniclers of its scope. There's, again, you know, Ed Burtynsky's work is very very admirable. I think he's really sort of in a very artful way brought home just the sort of completely inhuman scale of some of the stuff that we've been doing that has caused this problem. On the other hand, I mean, whether one particular island in Denmark, and you're talking about the island of Samsø, where I spent some time, that's completely eliminated fossil fuels in less than 10 years. That story, even though it's of only a very small group of people compared to the number of people working in factories in China, demonstrates, I think, how much possibility there is in the world, and in a way that I don't think. There's no doubt in my mind anyway that we are certainly not going to make the kind of changes we need to make terrifying images freak us out bad enough to I'm not even sure how that shift would look. So I guess my answer to that, and the way I sort of phrase it in the book, is there are basically as many little Danish islands as there are communities in the world. I mean, we all live in whether it's in the heart of a city or in a rural community, we live in groups of whatever, 1,500, 2,000, 5,000. And every single one of those groups of people could do what's being done on that island in Denmark. They would just simply have to find the will to do so. And I guess in a lot of ways what my book was intended to do is demonstrate how we find that will.
How do we find that? Not the will, I mean... After reading the book, I have the will. How do I find the means? I'm living in downtown Toronto. I can't put a windmill on my roof. I don't use my car for weeks at a time, but I feel my little recycling efforts every week aren't going to really turn the tide.
Right. Well, and I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all solution, and that was sort of the lesson of that island in Denmark and everything else, is that there's going to be, you know, as the National Geographic Future Power Issue put it, a Congress, not a king, that replaces the system that we're currently hooked into. But I think the way that starts to happen is that people, I think, have a vision of the future worth pursuing, and then begin asking the kinds of questions that we're talking about right now. How do we change? And not because we are terrified of where it looks like we're going, but because we're excited and exuberant, in fact, to get to a better place. And that, I think, is a much more powerful motive force than fear is.
You visited and spent quite a bit of time, I guess, with the people at Interface Carpeting. Can you describe some of the manufacturing innovations they've come up with that would have seemed ridiculous 20 years ago?
Yeah, well, Interface is, Ray Anderson, its CEO, has become, you know, fairly famous as the sort of official spokesman for corporate sustainability. He's, basically in the mid-90s had this sort of epiphany that, you know, as a the CEO of a company that takes basically a toxic material, raw material, and turns it into something that is toxic at the end of his life, that was no way to sort of tread upon the world. And without really knowing whether it was possible, said, you know, this company is going to become the first sustainable, 100% sustainable company on the planet. And obviously, that's pretty heady sort of terrain, and they were very much uncharted terrain when they made that shift. But the great thing about human
ingenuity, they are not a small company either. They are a big
multinational operation. the largest modular carpet company in the world. It's a multinational, multi-million dollar business. This is a very, very large undertaking. But the great thing about it is you realize that if you shift the parameters dramatically like that, engineers are very, very good at solving the problems as you present them to them, not as you would, you know, one day like them to. So in the book, I spent a lot of time with John Bradford, who's the vice president of research and development, and it's this big sort of strapping Alabama football coach kind of in demeanor, you know, engineers through and through, not an idealist in any sort of problem solver. And he talks about, you know, if you, you know, the first day in engineering school, you are taught to treat raw materials as abundant and inexpensive. You go into that, you know, and as he says, you know, he went to his team of engineers and said, let's pretend that's not the case. What if raw materials are extremely scarce and extremely expensive? How do we now rethink our manufacturing? And what they wind up doing is becoming, you know, extraordinarily zealous about wasting nothing, extraordinarily zealous about using as little raw material as possible, and so on and so forth. And so, among other things, they've completely closed their loop in terms of recycling. They basically, at the end of its useful life, they can take a piece of their own carpet and turn it back into a new piece of carpet, and that was sort of just one of the goals that they sort of set for themselves as a corporation. But the necessary first step was that deep commitment to say, we are going to do this. We are going to, one way or another, figure out how to make this a sustainable enterprise insofar as that's possible.
And at the end of that time with John Bradford, you ask in the book almost rhetorically, you know, Coach Bradford, why have other companies not followed our lead, your lead on this? And you don't answer I didn't find the answer in that section. What is the answer? Why are other companies not realizing that green can be profitable? And
I think they are now. That's sort of the, in fact, I think that's sort of the, I mean, the thing about it is that certainly they were the first ones to go at it so thoroughly. But I think their lead is now being followed quite far and wide. And in some very surprising places. I mean, you look at when Interface made its shift to sustainability, one of the first people, basically Ray Anderson assembled, you know, his sort of dream team to tell him what he should be doing. And Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, who I also talk about in the book, was one of the people on that dream team. Well, you know, Amory Lovins is now, for example, and his team are now, you know, completely making over Walmart's supply chain to make it much, much more energy efficient. And, you know, there are things to be debated about the overall sustainability of Walmart as a corporation, but the fact that a business that large is looking at, you know, doubling the efficiency of its trucking fleet and drastically reducing its carbon footprint, that to my mind is Ray Anderson's lead and Interface's lead starting to spread quite far and wide now.
You talk about Lovins and the Rocky Mountain Institute getting their refrigerator down to using 8%, for instance, of the power that a normal fridge requires. Mm-hmm. These guys seem to just riff on finding oddball ways to save energy. What are some of the other examples of things they've done over their, 20 years they've been doing it, 30 years?
Well, I mean, and actually, if you sort of trace Amory Lovins' career, it kind of looks like, it sort of describes the arc between fringe and mainstream. In the mid to late 70s, when Amory Lovins became an efficiency obsessive, he was sort of thought of as a bit of a quack, a bit of a strange man living up in the woods or up in the mountains in Colorado, you know, talking about all this stuff that big businesses didn't care about and didn't think was important. And so, you know, I mean, the actual headquarters of the Rocky Mountain Institute, one of the things they have is a whole bunch of batteries that they salvaged off of, I think it was a Chinese submarine, a decommissioned Chinese submarine, which they used to store the solar energy from all the solar panels on the roof. So that's sort of in a way where they began with these sort of jury-rigged, homespun kind of solutions in a lot of ways. And now they're, you know, the Institute headquarters itself has a perfectly tuned waterfall, because one day a Japanese visitor was there and said, oh, your waterfall is improperly tuned, just the way the water hits to create sort of a soothing background. So they've gone from sort of jury-rigged to the ultimate in creature comfort, and at the same time as a think tank have gone from this sort of fringe to now, you know, advising companies like Walmart and General Electric and the Pentagon even. And I think that demonstrates just how much in the heart of the mainstream now this thinking has become. And I think we're just starting to see the first trickles of it. I think it's going to be a pretty massive wave before too long. I think that there aren't many businesses, many organizations, many people who can afford to ignore this for very long.
You don't give us a checklist of things to do, but I left the book inspired, hopeful. It is a book about optimism and hope. What do we Westerners, though? We're not living in Thailand. We're not able to dash off to islands and help. We, I guess, could help with projects. But what can Westerners at home in Toronto or Calgary, what are our next steps to try and move this process along?
Well, I think, you know, feeling that sense of hope and optimism and enthusiasm is, that, to my way of thinking anyway, was the first step. And part of the reason I don't include, five bullet pointed list of, you know, the five things you should be doing is I don't know what your circumstance is. I don't know what sort of community you live in, what sort of institutions it's got that are capable of beginning to address this problem. I don't know what, you know, the energy requirements of your home are, how readily adaptable it is to, you know, certain kinds of retrofit. But I think getting people inspired to start asking those questions in their communities and in their workplaces and everywhere else is the way forward, not to sort of, you know, stand on the mountain and say, here are the five golden rules of the new world. Because I don't think, as I sort of say in the book, I don't think there is a solution. I think that there are, you know, just a multitude of solutions that, you know, will fit each community, each household, and or business, you know, in its own way. And if you look at like most of the success stories that I talk about in the book arose mainly from people asking those sorts of questions. I mean, you look at the Samsø, the island in Denmark. How did they eliminate fossil fuels? They took a look around. What sort of energy resources do we have readily available? We've got wind. We've got, you know, we've got the sun for district heating. We can build a high efficiency wood pellet furnace for district heating as well. What other sort of tools do we have? And you know, you just once you get going on it, it sort of becomes a second nature in a way.
Chris Turner is the author of The Geography of Hope, A Tour of the World We Need. Chris Turner, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, my pleasure.